Welcome to We Got Balls, real, raw, masculine sex talk with Chris Inman and Scott Cohn. Chris and Scott both work with men who want to leave their unwanted sexual struggles in the past. They are willing to do whatever it takes to help men get curious about what drives their compulsive sexual behavior. With that said, here we go.
Hey guys, welcome back to We Got Balls, and today we have a conversation that all of you guys are thinking, but rarely do you ever take the time to wonder why. We're going to talk about self-contempt. And if you go through your life wondering, why do I hate myself so much? Why is it so hard for me to accept compliments? Why do I feel like I'm always going to screw things up? Then you want to stick around for this conversation because we're going to get right into it.
So, Chris, we're talking about self-contempt, self-loathing, self-hatred today. Have you struggled with this? Has this been a thing for you?
No, Scott. I've always had a positive self-image, and every day I wake up with a smile on my face and a skip in my step, and I don't really struggle with this issue. I don't understand why guys would.
You fart rainbows, don't you? That's beautiful.
I do. I fart rainbows, and I sweat lollipops. And so that's what my life is about. Yeah. So no, dude, every freaking day, like every day of my life. In fact, I'll go to bed anxious and worried about how I'm going to screw things up. I'll wake up anxious and worried about how I'm going to screw things up. And it's like that old Greek mythology.
He rolls the big rock up the hill and rolls back down.
My ball is called self-contempt. Mm. That's what the name of my big boulder is.
So you got ball and not balls, and it's self-contempt.
No.
That's your biggest.
Most times I got a big low-hanging ball of self-contempt. Yeah. And I got a little tiny pea that's self-worth. Very, very tiny, very small little ball of self-worth.
So I'm really curious about this because it's something that I have definitely struggled with in my life. But now I'm just going to ask you a question. Were you born hating yourself?
You know, that's a great question. I don't think I was born hating myself. I think I learned that I was not worthy of care from a very young age. I think I had a mother who didn't know how to parent. She wasn't parented and was harmed in her childhood. And so I was dry and I was fed mostly, but I was not nurtured. And so from as far back as I can remember, I was trying to earn my worth by snuggling with people who would snuggle with me. I would sit on their lap and I would put my head on their chest and I would put my little hand up and play with their earlobes because I was trying to invite some worth. Please touch me, see me. And so I think it's an old story for me to feel like I'm not worth very much and I've got to kind of earn that or be good enough to deserve that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was.
How about you?
I think it was very much the same for me. Like I've realized now over time that I wasn't born hating myself, thinking I was a terrible, bad, worthless person, but I grew up in a family environment where my dad was really busy, was a real sports nut. I wasn't a sporty boy early on. And so I didn't feel like I qualified to meet his requirements for attention. And my mom was from an abusive background in her family, and she was dealing with the trauma of that and brought that into my life and in a lot of harmful ways with the emotional and some physical abuse. And so I, early on, the earliest memories I have as a five-year-old is I'm not wanted here. I did get some care from my grandmas, but it was sporadic, obviously, because I'm not living with them. So the day-to-day, my day-to-day existence was filled with feeling like I didn't belong and wasn't wanted. And that kind of set me up. And also then feeling like, well, I'm not into team sports like a lot of the other little boys. I'm not playing football, baseball as a little boy. And that's how so many boys feel like they belong and they're part of that, you know, the boy tribe. And I just felt really isolated and alone. What conclusion did I make out of that? What conclusion did you make out of the way you were treated?
I mean, in the moment, it really was, there was no conclusion. It was just survival. I think that's what took me the hardest when I was young, is I've got to get through this. I don't know why this is. I don't understand why I feel this way, but I got to go. I got to move. And I think when we're young, we have a lot of resiliency and hope just baked in us that it's not always going to be this way. And yet for me, I didn't get many people. I mean, I can probably count on one hand the number of people that I remember, and there probably were more than this, but the ones that I remember who really affirmed me, who really saw me and blessed me and invested in me in a tangible way from the time I was, from the time I can remember all the way up through graduating high school. And so it was survival mode for me. It was do what I got to do. And guys, I don't think this is unique. Like Scott and I aren't just, you know, two sad sacks over here having a conversation. I think this is a universal human condition. But the question is, you know, A, how do I go back and recognize the harm in my feelings of worthlessness and my self-contempt? And how do I change the narrative now? Because I can't go back and do anything about what I received when I was young. What I can do is change my perspective, and this really stood out to me, Scott, in this way. I talk to a lot of guys who, when they struggle with their unwanted behaviors, they shame themselves. I'm so mad at myself, or I keep going back to doing this. I don't understand why this is. I'm such a fuck up, and they use that kind of language to just intensify the self-contempt, and it saddens me because A, I've been there. And B, I don't want to go there anymore. I don't want them to go there anymore. I want them to see that while there's still a struggle going on, there's a value in every single human being that is intrinsic.
Yeah, so I was going to just start going down to talk about the relationship between shame and self-contempt, because the way I view this is shame is something that's done to us. Self-contempt is our own response to shame. It's a way for us to pay for being bad, worthless people. So shame is that experience where your mother or your father first, and then other adult figures that are, you know, important to your sense of your identity and attachment, treat you in a way that makes you feel like you're bad. Not that you've done something bad, but as all children do, we tend to turn the nose against ourselves. We don't have the mental capabilities of externalizing or modeling that this other person is simply upset with something that we've done. We feel like they're upset with us. And so when a child grows up in a very shaming environment where the nose, particularly nonverbal expressions of no, disapproval, looks of shame, you know, looks of scorn, looks of
or just nobody's there to do anything.
Nobody's there.
Neglect and abandonment. Yeah,
and you're left to fill in the pieces for yourself. Those experiences that happen over and over again then begin to hardwire your neurobiology to feel this constant state of shame. And so what do we do? Is that a pleasant feeling in the body? I mean, what does shame feel like to you when you've experienced it?
Oh, well, that's, you know, that's a whole conversation for another podcast, because, I mean, I think I've experienced shame in the neglect of my parents. I've experienced shame in the ridicule of family and friends, playful. Like I used to be the butt of jokes, and I don't know if that's because they thought I could take it I don't know what it was. I think I think it's the same thing like people who are abused, especially sexually abused. You know, they're abused because there is a goodness and a light in them that someone wants to consume. I think I was the butt of jokes because people saw something in me that they didn't express positively, but they expressed it with ridicule and joking. And then I had a lot of shame just in my day-to-day in my religious life. I mean, it was always be better, do more, you're not good enough. So all that kind of crystallized in my teenage years to where I just woke up at 11, 12, 13, just feeling like shit.
Where do you feel like shit in your body? And what does it feel like?
Oh, that's a great question. In my body, I think it's just a heaviness on my shoulders. Always a little tension there. I think what it leads to is an anxiousness about the way I make decisions. I'm questioning whether I have what it takes to do what I need to do. So that kind of lives right in my abdomen, on top of my stomach, bottom of my esophagus. Yeah, that's where it's typically lived.
Like a churning or like a nausea, aching,
knot. You know, it's like the anti butterfly. You know, you get butterflies in your stomach. I don't butterflies. I've got like a lead balloon,
yeah,
just hanging out right there.
Yeah. Shame to me, depending on how intense it is, it can feel like a sinking or a dropping, contracting feeling, kind of in my right below my sternum, like just wanting to get small. In fact, the shame posture that a lot of us adopt in our bodies is heads down, eyes, gaze averted, shoulders slumped forward, right? We all know what the look of shame looks like, but how it feels. The body is kind of collapsing forward, or it can be as intense as feeling like you got punched in the gut and all the color drains from your face, or it can be that heat of embarrassment. Oh, I'm so embarrassed about what happened. And so it's not a pleasant feeling. In fact, most scientists will tell you the feeling of shame in the body is one of the most existentially painful feelings, emotions that you can feel. And so we do things to get rid of shame. And self-contempt is actually a very effective tool that we adopt to get rid of shame. So
yeah,
why is
Scott, before we get to self-contempt, what other things do we do to get rid of the shame in our bodies?
We might masturbate.
Wow.
Because that feels really good.
Yeah, let's camp out right there for just a second. I've met a lot of guys who learn to masturbate at 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. Now, yeah, coupled with maybe some sexual abuse that might be there as well. I mean, the penis really isn't doing much at that age physiologically, right? And yet, there is a comfort level in that behavior for a boy who, you know, well, shame must be older. I mean, if you're masturbating at 5, you probably got some levels of shame in your body, right?
And we know this from developmental neurobiology that shame is hardwired as a core trait in the identity, as a feature of the identity, as early as 18 months of age. Prior to 18 months of age, if you put a red dot on a child's forehead and they look in a mirror, they will touch the child in the mirror because they don't realize that the thing that they're looking at is them. At about 14 to 18 months, self-awareness starts to develop. I start to realize I'm a different person than my mother. I start to individuate and separate. And now if you put a red dot on me, I'll touch it on my head. So as I become self-aware, I also become more susceptible to shame being used in my life. And there's a normal function where you say no to a child to prevent them from hurting themselves or from hurting others. But that's a shutdown in the neurobiology and that has to be repaired. But when you grow up in a home where shame is used unprincipally all the time to control behavior and it's never repaired, then by 3 years of age, that's hardwired in. You feel in your body, you're not thinking something's wrong with me, but you feel the feelings of shame in your body, which later on you start to put words to, something's wrong with me, I'm bad. And so that feeling can persist throughout your life. And so when I find a guy that was masturbating as a little boy, you're absolutely right. If you're masturbating at 3 or 4 or 5, it's not it's not normal behavior in the sense that children explore their genitals like all children do at various stages. But when masturbation becomes a self-soothing vehicle at a very early age, there's some emotional disturbance going on. And usually it's shame. Because I can go and touch my penis, and even though I'm not capable of ejaculating, I can have an orgasm. It feels good. It feels good to touch my penis when it's hard. It's before I have sex hormones, so testosterone is in there. I'm not eroticizing that experience at that point because I don't know what sex is. I don't know what eroticism is. But it's laying a stage for me to use that part of my body to feel good when I feel bad. And there's nothing worse than that. There's nothing that feels worse in the body than shame. So you see how sexual struggles actually come out of shame. They're caused by shame, core shame.
So what other struggles? Because, you know, before we get back to self-contempt, you mentioned, you know, masturbation is a result of shame. What else results from having shame in my body?
I might suck my thumb.
Okay.
I might have a blankie that I carry around. I become very object oriented in what I attach to instead of relationally.
So
I don't
unnatural. What's the word? Excessive attachment. There's something that I need to feel good.
Non-person relational attachment. Gotcha. So I attach to objects instead of people.
Gotcha.
So I don't see people as a source of comfort or lifting me out of my shame. I have to go auto-regulate myself. So what do? I'm using my body. I use an object that feels good to my touch. I may rock. Mm. There's lots of different ways that I can learn to feel better when I'm feeling bad about myself. And those become repetitive patterns in our lives. And if you've got behaviors, I might go to sugary food because it makes me feel good.
So that is transitioning to later in life. So we start to cope with behaviors and or substances that can help ease the feeling of shame in my body, right?
Yeah, and they work, right? They provide a temporary relief, and I start to feel better. And now this linkage between the bad feeling of shame and the relief I get when I do this particular behavior, or I go to this particular substance, or I go to this particular object, it gives me a sense of being alive again. Because shame feels like I'm dying. It's an existential kind of obliteration of the self. So when I do these other things, I'm looking for ways to feel alive again. And yet, those things over time end up making me feel more shame. So in the case of sexual addiction, we say sexual addiction is caused by shame. And its effect is more shame. We end up doing the very things that make us feel more shameful. So what do I have to do to get out? So self-contempt is just like any of those other strategies because it provides relief from my shame temporarily. So how is that possible? Why would hating yourself or punishing yourself in some way, restricting food, going and working out really hard. There's, you know, drinking to the point I get drunk. There's a lot of ways.
Procrastinating.
Well, how is that helping me? But the question is, in what way is self-loathing helping you? How does it help you? It doesn't help me. Yes, it does help you, or you wouldn't be doing it.
Yeah.
So let's be,
in the moment, it does.
Yeah. Let's be curious about it. And this is really kind of fascinating because one of the ways you could get out of that unpleasant feeling would be to cut yourself. And some people choose this, right? How does cutting myself help myself? Because it releases opioids and it temporarily numbs me to the pain of the shame. So I give myself a little source of pain to numb myself from the greater pain of shame. And that's all these behaviors can end up being that way.
Yep. Or a little source of pleasure, you know, whether it's food or alcohol or drugs or sex or gambling or video games or, you know, even for some people, there is a bit of you know, pain in work. If I just work too hard, I had a friend who was an exercise anorexic. When she felt bad about herself, she would go get on the treadmill. She would go to the gym and she'd work out 4 or 5 hours a day. She looked amazing until she didn't, till she looked like she was starving herself.
Yes. Yes.
Because what she thought she deserved.
And that's the same thing too. So there's all these different strategies that we use to try to escape these really unpleasant emotional feelings, primarily shame. It can be grief. It can be anger or fear, but a lot of times shame is the huge driver of this, particularly in sexual struggles. So, but I end up choosing something that makes me feel more shame. So I go to hate myself because it relieves me temporarily from the shame that I felt by acting out. And I feel like I'm atoning for what I've done.
So let's talk about that. Because I think that that's again, another type of, and what we've been describing is the addiction cycle. Shame, fantasy, ritual, acting out. Shame, fantasy, ritual, acting out. And some people may not think of, well, how is eating sugar an addiction cycle? Well, the fantasy is that if I feel this high in my body from the sugar, that that's going to relieve the shame. And so then I go get the bag of M&Ms or whatever your favorite food is, and I begin to eat that. And then I eat past the point of satisfaction to the point of binging and really hurting myself. And I'm like, oh, now I'm back. Where am I back at again?
Shame.
I shouldn't have eaten those M&Ms, right? And that's
something's wrong with me.
Something's wrong with me. Why? And I hate myself for it. And why do I do it? But there's this, you know, there's this belief that more shame is going to get me out of this cycle. If I try harder, if I do better, if I be more, and I want to be, put your listening ears on, folks. Listen to the people around you. And if they're using language that is about self-improvement for self-improvement's sake, or about pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, or about working harder with no kindness whatsoever in the equation, realize that you're being invited into another addiction cycle.
And self-contempt is addictive.
It is.
So why self-contempt? Because it allows me to pay for my shamefulness. And I feel that somebody has to pay, and I'm the one that did it, so I've got to punish myself. So it's a form of self-punishment, self-judgment, self-condemnation. And it's interesting that, like, for this feeling of falling short, we believe that we have to pay. We have to pay a price. And so self-contempt is really that whole structure then that says, I'm worthless. I have to pay for that. I have to pay for that.
I've got to earn my way out of it.
Yeah.
And that's the dynamic that is really, it's really what religion is based on, what human religion is based on, is this, there somebody has to pay for the badness. And well, yeah,
the gods have to be appeased.
Yes. So the gods have to be appeased. And in Christianity, well, Jesus paid for my sins, but yet I've let him down again. Here I am back in that same dark hole. I've got to dust off my white clothes and come back and do enough good works to be presentable, to be pleasing to this God, or he'll be angry with me again. When that's nothing could be further from the truth.
And you know, I have to say that I think you have to look at the gospel through the lens of how God is actually dealing with our shame and our self-contempt.
100%.
Because it's like he's saying with the crucifixion, I know you guys want to punish yourselves. You can't make your own atonement.
Yeah.
So I'm going to do it for you so that you're free. And that's why Romans, there is no condemnation for those in Christ Jesus. Like, if God has taken care of this, you don't need to condemn yourself. There's no place for self-contempt. And so that tendency to want to atone for our own sins, I think, is what's really driving this whole shame, self-contempt cycle. And it is a cycle, and it's vicious. And it just leads to this continually reinforcing of the very behavior that you're trying to stop in the first place. So what's the solution?
Yeah, it's a great question. In my experience, it's been the antithesis of earning my salvation, of earning my justification, of earning my goodness. It is receiving the goodness that I did not earn, and not in an idea sense, not like assenting that, oh, I'm a good person, but in a relational sense. Sitting across from another human being and listening to them say, I love you. I really respect the path that you're on. You encourage me. I am glad to be with you. You have a gift here. You're so kind. You're so intelligent. You're so generous. And man, when I first started receiving those words, they felt like hollow compliments because I could not believe that they could be true. And it was years before I was willing to open myself up to hear those words and go, maybe they are true. Maybe there is something about this that, yeah, I'm a piece of crap sometimes, but really, am I truly a piece of crap, or do I just feel like that? Maybe I'm really better than I think I am, than I feel I am, and I just struggle. And I got that relationally.
Because you got the shame and the self-contempt relationally.
Oh, well, Scott, tell me more about that. Is it maybe the fact that we don't learn anything first and foremost informationally? We learn everything first and foremost relationally. And then I put language and ideas to explain what I've already experienced.
That is exactly how we learn. It is modeled for us.
Yes.
It's caught, not necessarily taught explicitly. Yeah. And we catch it through those interactions, first with our mother and father, and then with others and so on. And we extend that over to God, and we transfer that insecurity that we have in our family relationships over into our relationship with God. And it takes fundamentally a change in how we relate to one another for us to change within ourselves. We are incapable of change on our own, bootstrapping it, like we say.
So you're saying Scott, put a point on it, that there's no way for me to listen to podcasts or read books or go through online courses or memorize principles. There's nothing in that that's going to help me feel better about myself. I can't improve my self-worth through informational means only.
No, because you weren't harmed informationally. You were harmed relationally. You were told things, you were made to feel things in relationships, and then you began to tell yourself those things and internalize them. And if that's ever going to change, you have to have different relational experiences than the ones that formed you. And that's what I see God ultimately doing in the gospel, is he brings us into a fundamentally new relationship with him because of what Jesus does, taking away. And it's two things. It's not just, do I have to earn my keep? But what is done with all of the times when I have violated God, have violated others, I've violated myself. Well, who takes care of all of that?
Let's be very clear. It didn't become real for many of us until there was a human being that operated as God and was able to be, as God has always been, gracious and kind and forgiving and merciful and redemptive in his relational dynamics. And so I would argue that if you want to read the text of Scripture, the thrust is you got to feel it in your body with other people before you can believe it in your head and say that it's true. And so the only way to heal self-condemnation, as in the economy that we live in, is to have gracious, non-condemning experiences with other people.
Totally agree. And I started a firestorm on my Facebook page this week with a post where I said, walk by faith, don't trust your feelings, is the most despicable advice a Christian could give another person.
Yeah, that's some bullshit.
And man, I had people coming after me for that, and I had to explain, here's what I mean by feelings. And there's a big confusion in the culture around what's a feeling and what's a thought. And these guys would say, well, I feel that. And I said, every time you say I feel that and it's followed by a thought, I'm going to point that out. You're not telling me what a feeling is. You're telling me what a thought is. And you're absolutely right that if we're ever going to change those feelings in our bodies of feeling worthless, and then our thought that I have to punish myself, I got to pay for this in some way, or I've got to earn my keep, both of those things, they're done away with in this new way of relating to God through relating to one another.
It requires three parts to be loving. You got to have a relationship with yourself. You got to be willing to look in the mirror and say, this is who I am. Know my identity, number one, and know my purpose, number two. And those are different stages.
Well, you have a relationship with yourself, whether you think you do or not.
I'm aware. But until I do the work to be intentional about that and know who I am and why I am. And again, first half of life work is who am I? Second half of life work is why am I? And that some of that overlaps. Number two, I believe, Scott, I can't know myself really well unless I know other people, because they're reflections of what they see in me. That's why those groups, when people reflect back to me, the people that I talk to are always more positive and encouraging and gracious about me than I am about myself. And ultimately, our relationship with God is wrapped up in our relationship with ourselves and our relationship with others and how it expresses itself in the big picture story. So all three of those, caring, being kind, loving, those different aspects of the people in my life are necessary. And like we talk about all the time, they're held in tension. If I am losing one of the three, I don't have the tension. I don't have the reality. And frankly, as we talked about earlier, a lot of the self-contempt that we have comes from the fact we didn't develop a healthy view of self because there wasn't a healthy adult in our lives to help us see who we really were and care for us in the time we needed it.
And because of that, we tend to be very isolated. We tend to want to handle this on our own because I believe I'm a bad, worthless person. That just reinforces my sense of shame and reinforces my tendency to use self-contempt to try to change. All of that breaks apart when I'm in a community where I can be known the way I really am. I'm not hiding. I'm not keeping secrets. This is who I really am. And I learned that I can be loved even when I've had my worst day, even when I've been at my worst.
You know what scares me the most, Scott, when I hear a guy say, all I need is me and God? Because when I hear that man say that, it scares me, but it also saddens me. Because the truth is, you can't know God without others. You can't know self without others and God. So really what he's saying is, I don't know what I need. I'm lost. And, you know, it's hard to call someone out on that. And sometimes I've had to just be very blunt and say, my friend, I love you. But to make that statement means that you don't understand the equation at all. And so what we're inviting you guys to is take a risk to be with safe people. The hack for self-contempt is interaction, vulnerability, attunement, connection, authenticity with safe people. It will solve many of your God problems. It will solve many of your you problems, and it can solve your shame problem, not magically, but in a far speedier way than trying to grind your way through it on your own.
And let's define safe people as people who can welcome every part of you, not try to fix it.
Yes.
But just be with it.
Yes. Withness. Withness is the definition of safety. And that's why we want to invite you guys to be with us. We're going to be live May 24th, Friday, May 24th at 11 a.m. Central, 12 Eastern, 9 Pacific on YouTube. And you can show up.
We Got Balls YouTube channel.
Yeah, the We Got Balls YouTube channel. If you don't see us on YouTube, you listen to the podcast, go check that out. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel so you can find it. But on that day, you can bring all your questions. What turns you on? Why is the sky blue? How many angels can you fit on the head of a pin? All those questions, we'll be answering those definitively on that day. And if you can't come that time, feel free to send us your questions at wegotballs00@gmail.com. You can send those via email. And so we want to continue to connect with you and be a part of your life and be with you, because that is the joy that we have. Really, it's the fruit of our own relationship, isn't it, Scott? We love just being with each other. So
we do.
Why not multiply, man? We're excited to be with you guys. So until the next time we're together, we want you to encourage yourself and connect and remind yourself that was terrible and I hate it and I'm going to do it again. So until next time, we just wanted you to remember that you can't end this thing. You got to end it. End it.
So guys, join us here again next time.
Hold on. We don't want to end this, guys. We don't want to end it.
Why don't you guys just stay with us all day?
What a go great on forever. Time. Right here on We Got Balls.
And you do too.
Take care.
Don't forget to subscribe for more episodes. You can connect with Chris and with Scott at successfulmen.com.